Stephen Heller wears many fashionable hats. For more than 30 years, he was art director for the New York Times Book Review. He currently serves as co-chair of the MFA Design as Author program at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. He was the co-founder of several other design criticism programs. He blogs at the Daily Heller. He's the editor of the AIGA Voice and contributes to a variety of other venerable design-related sites and venues. He was a friend of Paul Rand, who's the subject of our conversation today, and is the author of a monograph on Rand published by Faden in 1999. Did I get all that right, Steve?
Well, the bio is an old one, so things have changed.
I haven't mentioned the number of books, and it truly is incredible, the number of books that you've co-authored or authored.
There are about 200.
One of the things that you mentioned in your book about Rand is his commitment and dedication to his craft and hard work. You share that with him.
Well, I share the concept, I guess. He was much more of the practitioner than I am. Design, particularly graphic design, was his life. He was a dyed-in-the-wool modernist, which meant that he had a design philosophy which he stuck to and didn't allow trend or fashion to dictate what he was going to do. He followed his instincts, he followed his passions, he followed the idea that there is a right way of addressing form and that all content can be enhanced through that right way.
Yeah, he was a real student of the art craft. He went to the New York Public Library and studied every art book and graphics, European graphics annual he could get his hands on.
He pretty much taught himself. Yeah. He went to the Art Students League for drawing because he knew he needed to draw as the foundation of his visual language. He had gone to Pratt also to pick up the skills that were necessary for his trade. Design in the 1920s and 30s was not an exclusive profession. It was not driven by the muse. It was driven by practicalities and pragmatics. Rand understood that, while at the same time, he did think of himself in the same boat as many of the artists who were working in Europe at that time, who were also artists slash pragmatists slash entrepreneurs.
Why did he think that drawing was so important?
Well, why does the Board of Education think we should know how to speak good English or do mathematics or any of the STEM ideas that are the core of education today in the West and possibly in the East and the North and the South as well? He felt that it was a language. He felt he could express himself by drawing. He understood very clearly that language was also words, and words formed sentences, and sentences formed paragraphs, and that was how ideas were conveyed. But he also felt that many people were multilingual in that they could speak through word and image.
So what? Knowing how to draw based on the evolution of the craft, based on traditions, based on techniques that were proven over time to be the right, quote unquote, way to do it was important?
Well, there was that, all of those things, but there was more. That drawing would open up certain windows, doors, chests. You would find through drawing, he in fact, he once showed me a poster that he had seen when he was in school. And he was amazed that the shapes echoed one another. It was a poster for cigarettes. And I think it's in the biography. There was a Greek looking sculptural figure, and he was wearing a wreath of laurel around his head, and the leaves of the wreath echoed the shape of the cigarette, which was an oval shaped cigarette. I remember seeing cigarettes like that when I was a kid.
Sounds like a fat reefer.
Very fat and formed. It was clearly done by a machine, but he thought that that was more amazing than the technique that the artist used, which involved airbrush and shading and, you know, making a very sculptural looking drawing. That was technique. That was style. What he was looking for and found was elements beyond that, that made it stand up. That was its foundation.
He loved what? The fact that they, as you say, echoed each other because it was eye-catching or appealing to the eye?
Yeah, it was subversive, subtly relatable. You know, there are lots of things that people do as nuance that actually have a great deal of covert power. You know, it's Aldous Huxley wrote a book called Brave New World Revisited.
Yeah.
And it was about subliminal advertising, among other things, how our minds would be controlled as they are today through all this media. And it was through subterfuge, which can be good and it could be bad. You know, it has the odor of stink, but getting into one's head with subtleties is not a priori a terrible thing.
No. He was born in 1914 of Jewish Polish origins, and he changed his name.
He changed his name. His real name was Peretz Rosenbaum. He changed his name to a name that apparently was in his family. Peretz was akin to Paul, and Rand was the name that belonged to an uncle of his. But what he was most proud of is that each of those words, Paul and Rand, had four letters and could line up perfectly.
All right. Always the what? Always the designer. Always with an eye for how things looked.
Ultimately, yeah.
Well, you tell the story of how he started drawing the, was it the Palm Olive Girl at age 3?
Yeah, whether that's apocryphal or not, I don't know. Yeah. His parents were Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews. A certain segment of his family, up until the time that he died, were Hasidic. And so, presumably, there was the graven image prohibition, biblical prohibition in there. But he had a little drawing table and chair and or bench, and he would draw advertisements in the back of his father's store. So it's a way of teaching oneself. He would also use the comics, which is the tool of a lot of American artists, and particularly New York kids. For many people, comics or comic-like drawings are the first introduction to art you have.
He started out working on some magazines. And some of the names of those magazines are Apparel, Art, PM, Directions. And also he was in the what they called the Esquire Bullpen. What was that?
Well, Apparel Arts, Esquire, Coronet, and a short-lived magazine called Ken were all part of the Esquire Coronet Company, which began in Chicago. A man named Smart was one of the owners, along with Arnold Gingrich, who ran Esquire. In New York, they had an office on Madison Avenue. And the bullpen was a place where artists who were hired, commercial artists, would do their work. They were called board men or layout artists or mechanical artists. And a bullpen was just a big holding area where all the drawing boards were. And when I worked at the New York Times, we had a bullpen, and those were the people who were more generalists, while art directors were assigned to specific magazines or newspapers. But he also worked for a number of other studios. He worked for the Schwitzer studio, George Schwitzer, who was an industrial designer. He worked for a company that made stock images for newspapers and magazines, which were used a lot. We call them clip art. He later on worked for and was the youngest art director of a New York City advertising agency called the Weintraub Agency.
So he, throughout that sort of part of his career, he was an art director at an ad agency. So he designed ads. He later went on to corporate logos and identities, IBM and Westinghouse and ABC, among others. But it's interesting that you suggest that he was proudest of the books, which, of course, is what we're concerned with, the books that he designed.
I think he was proudest of the books and of the magazine covers. He was not, in his heart of hearts, fond of systems, although he created them particularly for the corporate clients. But a book cover, a book jacket, was something that was a piece of art in and of itself. It was a standalone. And although he did a few series for a couple of well-known companies, like Wittenborn Books, he did a series, Schocken Books, or not Schocken, but...
he was with Knopf early.
Did Knopf, but the Knopf books, he never did real series. He did one-offs.
Oh, yes, okay.
And... yep. In those, he was able to work with type, lettering, imagery, color, shape, form, all of the elements that come together that are ultimately called graphic design. And each one was a new one. You could always tell they were RANs. One reason was obvious, because he signed everything he did, which was
right.
Relatively unique. There were other graphic designers who did sign their work. But for the most part, graphic designers were anonymous figures.
Well, he had enough stature to be able to do that, I guess.
Well, he ended up having enough stature because he did it.
Well, okay, so what is it? How come they let him put his name on it? And you don't really see that often.
Well, just as a matter of happenstance, you know, he might have just started doing it at a particular time, and that just became his modus operandi. And at a certain point, he once told me a story about signing a brochure that he did, which was a beautiful brochure for Autocar Corporation, which was making tanks during World War II. And the creative director or whoever was responsible for it didn't want him to put his name on it. He said he would pay the $50 it cost to make the lead slug with his name on it. And he made claims that he told people, if the name doesn't go on it, you don't get the work.
Well, that's the thing. The work was paid so poorly. If this was all he was asking, and they were paying him a pittance, that's no skin off their nose. I guess that's...
Well, you could say that, or you could say that putting somebody else's name on a cover elevates the creator to the author's status. And that's what he was. He was an author of images. But, you know, there was a hierarchy. And to this day, you rarely see an editor's name on a book, unless it was a collection, an anthology. More and more you'd see editors' names on the contents pages or copyright pages. But he felt that he deserved that kind of notice.
Well, you talk about an epiphany that he had, seeing art and design as being united.
Yeah. The only difference was the purpose that the art was done for or put to. So if you're creating something that's just purely functional, you're not necessarily going to call it art, but it might be artful and somebody else will give it that name. If you're doing something that has no functional purpose except to express a feeling or a thought, then somebody still has to decide whether it's art or not. He never really said overtly that what he's doing is art. He says what he's doing is as good as he can do within his media. And I once joked with him that his home, which he and his second wife designed, she was an architect, and it was a very modernist Corbusier box, very lovely in Connecticut. And we were standing in his living room, which was pretty minimalist. It had two Paul Klees on the wall, a Corbusier drawing somewhere. Later, he sold those to pay for his archive after he was dead. And I said, the thing I like about you, Paul, is you don't pretend to be a painter. And he took me into his bedroom, and there were all these paintings. Some looked a little like Cézanne. Some looked like his own work. He used to do collage with colored pieces of paper, and some of the watercolors and aquarelles and oil paintings had that feel to them. They were very loose and playful and modern in the manner of a Paul Klee or Juan Miró.
Yeah, at one point you claim the wish to be his Boswell. There's a reference to that.
I don't know. I didn't want to be anybody's Boswell.
No.
I enjoyed interviewing him many times.
Yeah. Became
friends, and nothing was recorded. So I got a lot of his wisdom and a good deal of his wit, but it was never recorded except what I could keep in my memory, which is fast disappearing. It wasn't until after he died that I wrote the obituary for him for the New York Times. And shortly after that, I got a call from Fiden asking if I would write a book about him. And I did it in a way I wanted to, of course, but that's not why I did it. I felt I kind of owed it to him.
Why is that?
Well, just because we were friends and I was chronicling him. I was taking everything he said basically at his word. I wasn't the kind of biographical critic that, you know, some biographers are, like Robert Barrow or Johnson. Mine was a professional relationship, so there were things about his personal life that I never found out or that I did know and never put into the book because they were private.
Yeah, I mean, the book, beautiful, beautiful book, is really an exploration of the range of areas that he practiced in. It's really not, it's not a biography per se.
No, it's a monograph.
Yeah.
I call it a professional biography because it's like I have honorary doctorates and I tell my students, if you want, you can call me doc. So if you want, you can call me a biographer, but I'm just reporting.
Okay. Well, you do a damn fine job of it because it's unusual to read intelligent, incisive evaluation of any kind of art, I think, but particularly the graphic arts. The book stood out in that regard for me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it gets into details like, for example, that he uses and used arresting humorous images. That was one of the ways that he operated.
Yeah, he had a sense of humor and he had a visual sense of humor. And many of the people that I've written about as designers from his generation and from later generations and even earlier generations had that sense of humor that came out through pictures or through typography. I mean, I have a book out now called Type Speaks, and there's a number of sections in there on how wit plays a role in setting type and how you experience the meaning of the words that are being presented to you differently based on the kind of type styles that were used. In yeah. Rand's case, he stuck pretty much to a few simple faces in his palette, but he would go a little crazy sometimes and do collage lettering or hand lettering that was not calligraphic, but really from the hand, which he made a big point of distinguishing that calligraphic lettering was very studied and very tight. And his handwriting was in the modern sense, kind of an abstraction that also had a meaning.
It was also a function of economics too, wasn't it? It didn't cost that much for him to do that.
No, it was, it cost a lot to use vendors in those days. Hot type, hot metal type was expensive. And the pay, as you said earlier, was not that high. So if you could save money by drawing your own type, which many designers did in a more formal way, or using handwriting, you'd save a bit more for your own coffers. And he was far from the only person to do that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of his humor, I'd just like to quote here on page 26, where you say, but between 1937 and 1938, Rand was putting in practice and therefore setting a standard for a variant of modernism that was not merely a sampling of foreign influences, but rather a synthesis of European formalism and design philosophy fused with American vernacular, function, and wit, which ultimately became Rand's signature.
Right. That's a long way of saying that he didn't just copy or mimic, that, you know, there were enough people doing what the handbooks told them to do or what their teachers told them to do. Mm-hmm. Do it this way and you'll be stylish. Do it this way and you'll create a particular look, or think for yourself and maybe something original will come out. And that's the wonderful thing about art. There can be the school of a certain painter, you know, the school of Rembrandt, the school of Picasso, Cubism. Hopefully those artists who were schooled by the masters grow into something else, and you can still see where they came from, but you also see something totally different.
Yeah, I guess that's the ideal. What set him apart, though, and you do mention this, is that he was uncompromising. And he, I guess, because he was so good, he had the luxury of being uncompromising.
Well, I know, you know, it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. Was he uncompromising because he was so good, or was he so good because he was uncompromising? You know, he was a ballsy kid.
Yeah.
Grew up in Brooklyn, immigrant parents. He was breaking with the traditions that were laid out for him to follow. He ultimately followed many of those traditions in his older years. I used to joke with him because he, on Jewish High Holy Days, he would do prayer during the day. And, you know, as a young New York Jewish kid, I stopped doing that when I stopped practicing piano when I got old enough to say, I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
I would call him on certain high holy day mornings and see if he picked up the phone or not. And when he did, I'd say, I got you.
Now, maybe you could help define this then, because here's what Laszlo Moholy Nagy, who had left Nazi Germany to found the new Bauhaus in Chicago, celebrated Rand's graphic design as the essence of modernism in America. So what is that essence then? What is it?
Well, the essence is, first of all, America. When we're talking about America, we're not talking about the hinterlands. We're not talking about the Midwest.
Right.
We're not talking about the polarities that exist today. We're talking about the major industrial cities like New York, Chicago, perhaps Los Angeles, to a certain extent, Boston, where industrialization is responsible for the way the cities look and operate. And, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, the European artists like Moholy Nagy looked to America as being this beacon in the world of progress, mm-hmm. progressive thinking, not just social thinking. There was a group that believed in the socialist ideals, but also in terms of technological progress, whether it's radio or automobiles or construction. You know, New York had skyscrapers, Chicago had skyscrapers. These were unheard of in Europe.
Right.
So Paul Rand represented that along with others. You know, there was a whole coterie of industrial designers who were called white knights of industry, Raymond Loewy, Henry Dreyfuss.
You say represented. How did he represent that?
In his work, there was a simplicity amidst a certain complexity. And the streamline ethic of that particular era, what was dubbed the streamline ethic, or the modernist ethic that kind of reflected the Bauhaus, was mm-hmm. reflected in Paul Rand's work. Again, it wasn't mimicry, but it was taking the ideas of you strip away all that's unnecessary, all the decoration that came before it. It was no longer necessary to have rounded edges. You had angular edges, rectilinear work rather than curvilinear work. For some, they seem very simple and unimportant. For others, it was a major statement to shift from one formality to another. And Rand represented that. He thought about it all the time. He wrote about it. He was a very prolific writer. And he would quote the great philosophers that appealed to him. Santayana was one. Roger Fry was another. And some of the people who were slightly older but contemporary of him, Louis Mumford. There were many people that kind of traveled in the same circle and thought the similar thoughts.
Right. And
that's where this, what is called mid-century modern, comes from it, what it's all about. It's about shifting the standards and paradigms of making things into an industrial mode. And going back to his corporate design, one of the things he did for Westinghouse, for example, when he created their entire corporate identity from redesigning the logo to the packaging, one of the big things that a lay person wouldn't necessarily consider it to be a remarkable invention was he made the wattage the single most important typographic element on the box, whereas many other companies made their logo the single most important element. But when you're in a store looking at shelves for a particular product, what are you going to look for?
Yeah, you're making their job easier, aren't you?
So, and that's what modernism was all about. It was about making life easier and life more efficient. And that's what the industrial designers were trying to do in streamlining. That all came to a head with the 1939 New York World's Fair, which Rand didn't have anything to do with, or at least not much to do with. He did one piece that echoed the World's Fair. But, you know, that was the kind of excitement and progress that was coming out of the Depression and got subsumed by World War II and then ultimately made America into the world's greatest industrial country after the war was over. So all of these things kind of fit together historically. And while you can peel apart the different parts of the ethos of the time, so you have Paul Rand over here and Alvin Lustig over here and Lester Beale over here, and you have the architects like Frank Lloyd Wright over here and Mies van der Rohe and the like. They're all part of one thing. that becomes emblematic of a period of time, which was the overthrow of fascist regimes and the growth of multinational corporations, which some people might call one and the same.
You've actually written a book on how the fascists used graphic design.
Well, the fascists and the communists, I lump them together as totalitarian.
Yeah. Well, let's just take a look at what you say about Rand's process. You say that the key to his process was beginning each project with the same fundamental concern, imbuing every surface, page, poster, box, bottle with the same sense of proportion, balance, harmony, and at times dissonance, if the outcome demanded it. Invariably, the solutions would be different, but the problem was always the same: how to arrange diverse elements to achieve aesthetic perfection and clear communication. For Rand, graphic design was a process of conveying messages intelligently, interestingly, and wittily. It seems to me that, and this came up actually in a conversation I had with about literary criticism with Daniel Mendelsohn. It's so patently obvious, but you know, these great practitioners are really, really smart. They're intelligent, and that's obviously part of their genius. It's, you know, they've got that, plus they've got the ability to communicate it either visually or with words.
Yeah, and you know, they were working for a purpose. They were working to appeal to you and me, or the you and me's of then and there. Everybody who creates within our kind of world is communicating something. You boil it all down to communication, whether the communication is through the symbolism of a building or the symbolism of a typeface.
Well, they're also competing for your attention, is what this is what they're after. And even if there is a kind of an ulterior motive which may undermine and put them lower on the hierarchy in some people's eyes, they're still using a lot of the same techniques, aren't they?
Definitely. And that's why many of them, after their kind of work is exhausted for whatever reason, you know, most graphic designers have styles, and most styles go in and out of fashion.
Yeah.
They're no different than clothing creators. At a certain point, the majority of designers are going to stop being relevant, or they'll simply lose their luster. You know, it's not true across the board. Most of my friends now, who I deeply respect and admire, are in their 90s and they're still producing great work. And Paul was late into his 80s when he passed away. And the last thing he did was a logo for the hospital that he was being cared for in.
Just turning to books, what was it about books, his books, that made them stand out?
Well, I think you have to look at what was being done at the time. It's the similar bifurcation today. There's the mass market and then there's the specialized. There was the academic and scholarly, and there was the pop nonfiction. Much of what Paul was asked to design were the things that didn't require a huge author's name or a huge author having his name huge on the cover, which became what was known as the big book look. Although there may be one or two covers of his that are very iconic insofar as they're still used today. Most of those covers and some of the jackets were, you know, for immediate stimulation. They got you looking. He probably never read the entire books that he was illustrating, as most book jacket designers don't. They read summaries. When I was art director of the book review section, I read one out of every eight books that I put on the cover. And that may be generous. There was a period of time when I started reading them all because they were such good books, but that came and went in flashes. But you know, you try to, as an interpreter, a visual interpreter of a book, to make something that will both stimulate the reader's or consumer's attention and give a little hint of what's inside. So the adage, you can't tell a book by its cover, really has a lot of impact and a lot of meaning when it comes to the modernist book covers.
You say that his covers were matchless owing to the humor of his collage and the economy of his pen line. What does that mean?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, some of what I say has a bit of hyperbole wired into it. Were they matchless? You could always tell a Paul Rand cover. So there was always some nuance that made it Paul rather than somebody else. So in that sense, they're kind of matchless. But his pen line, when he drew elements, whatever that element might be, whether it was a sun or, you know, a figure of some kind, it always had his signature attached to it, not his literal signature, but his figurative one. And there were others who worked in his style. You and I are going to talk about Alvin Lustig. I often show Lustig compared to Rand, because even though they go off in very different directions, they come together and cross over in certain places as well, because that's the nature of the language. You know, you and I, you speak with rounded O's because you're from Canada, and I speak with no R's because I'm from New York.
Right, but thankfully we understand each other.
Yeah, we do have English in common.
I'm looking at a picture of the first book that he designed for Knopf, and it's funny. I think it's probably because I read about it in another book of yours. When we first met, we talked about a book about dust jackets that you'd done. I believe it was in there. It might have been somewhere else, but I actually found a copy of it online, and it was in Chicago. So I happened to be driving through Chicago, so I stopped at the bookstore, and the bookstore was the best bookstore name that I think I've ever come across. It's called the Armadillo's Pillow. And that's where I found The Tables of the Law by Thomas Mann that Paul Rand designed.
And isn't that a great cover? It's low key, high energy.
Yes, it's a Michelangelo statue on the right-hand side, just sort of staring in, right?
Right, of the law. And he's cut off so that he doesn't bleed off the cover. He's just cut off, and there's a mass of black, I believe, underneath it. Yeah. I love that cover.
I do too, and I'm so happy.
Jacket, actually.
It's the jacket, yes. Well, the cover itself has got all sorts of interesting little symbols on it, like Paul Klee type symbols right on the cover itself.
Right, and that was common with a number of designers. They use that kind of, you know, they're almost like syllabaries, but they're not. But they come from cave paintings. And Paul Rand once wrote, one of his books' subtitle was From Lascaux to Brooklyn.
This, the law, the tables of the law, the cover, he's got the type on the title, the law, at the same level as the statue's head is cut off. So it just, something about that is really appealing. It's sort of in sync.
And the way he did it, you know, it's not clear whether he did it because there was some philosophical reason or he was just...
Yes, just playing with your mind. Yeah.
What he often said was, you know, you do something because you do it, and then once it's done, you make up all these excuses to explain it.
Right, right. Or wonderfully philosophical sounding, erudite, explanations. He used a great line. At the bottom, there's this strip of white, and I think you said something like, it looks like a blind that hasn't been pulled all the way down. A lovely description.
Well, the great thing about any art is that you can make your own interpretation and come up with a sentence to describe it, whether it's right or wrong. Maybe the artist will say, that's perfect. I wish I could have said that myself. Or yes. They say, you're full of crap.
They are the ones that know the truth about the intention, of course, but it is a lot like a novel not being complete until the reader brought their imagination to it.
I often used to do work when I did design work without any real conception of why I was doing it, except it looked good. And I'd show it to the editor and the editor would start deciphering it. And I'd say, yep, you're absolutely right. That's what I was trying to get at.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Let them do the thinking.
Exactly.
Just quickly, a couple of other of my favorites, Rand jackets and covers, Leave Cancelled.
Yeah, there's a quick story I'll tell you about that.
This is the one with a kind of a cherub on the jacket and a bunch of actual circular holes.
Very perfect holes. Yes. Bullet holes.
Bullet holes, yes.
But they were modernist bullet holes. So they were just perfect circles. He had to get permission from Alfred Knopf to do that, who showed it to his wife. And his wife said, it's great, but it's going to cost us 2 or 3 more cents on the cover. And they did it. And it was about a soldier who had come back from the war on leave. He married his true love. His leave was canceled. He went off to war, World War I, and he was killed. And so that, you know, speaks, the cherub speaks to love. The holes speak to death.
Yeah.
It's just a perfect evocation of what that book meant. And you don't even have to read the book.
Yeah, no, I love that cover. And I love the Mencken cover. Prejudice is a selection where they've taken this god-awful close-up picture of his fat face. He's built this body around. Well, you know it, of course.
What he told me about that, I guess it was pretty obvious, is that what he was given were a couple of press handouts. And that Mencken photograph you can see in almost any book where Mencken appears, and he just wanted to do something different with it.
Yeah.
Some designers would just say, okay, let me put big type over the body and let it be. But he cut the shape of a man holding his finger up as an orator. Very rough. And
very primitive,
Put a couple of color blocks around it, also very roughly done. Scrawled in some words, and there you go. Pop, poop, it's a cover.
Well, and it's one of the most, I think, attention-grabbing covers I've ever seen.
Yeah, and a lot of people are doing work like that today. That's the thing about Paul's work. Those things that you've been pointing out, we don't know what timelessness is, really, because we don't know what time really is, but certainly they're enduring. And so what he did there doesn't get caught up in the mess of style and fad.
Yeah, you say that, and we've touched on it, that he reduced complexities to a single idea. He distilled the essence. That's on book jackets and covers and such.
Yeah, that's the nature of a designer. It's taking complexity and making it edible. And that's what logos are. That's why he was so good at doing logos. When he started doing logos as an advertising art director, they were a bit more complicated, a bit more narrative than the ones he did for UPS or Westinghouse or IBM or Cummins Engine or whatever he was doing. But it all came down to simplicity.
Simplicity, but obviously maintaining the meaning, if it's possible. I guess that was the challenge, right?
That's the nature of any of these things. You know, we know the Red Cross because it's a Red Cross and it's been applied to medicine and rescue. So we know what it stands for, and it's stood the test of time for all these decades and centuries as representing something. And it's a simple form. It's not something that has a nurse with her head bonnet on or holding a ethoscope or something like that.
You write that Rand made modern art friendly.
Yeah, I say that, you know, more as a personal statement. When I was a kid, I went to Saturday and Sunday school at Museum of Modern Art. I was used to art in books being very representational, very realistic. So I had to get used to this idea that Picasso was taking reality and tearing it apart and putting it back together again. And Rand pretty much did the same thing. He would be the first to say, this is what Paul Klee did, this is what Picasso did, this is what Juan Gris did.
But he did it in such a way that was designed to attract attention long enough for you to, or enough attention, the right kind of attention, so that you'd open the book and at least read the first page.
He would hope. I mean, some things he did were clunky. When you're looking for ideas, you're not going to, you know, hit 100%.
No.
You're going to do better than a baseball batter, but, you know, if you hit your mark at a 700 batting.
Yeah, that's decent. Yeah.
It's pretty decent.
Yeah. He made scholarship playful.
Yeah, he took himself seriously, and he took the forms that he was working with seriously, and he took art and thought seriously, and he took literature seriously, but serious doesn't necessarily rule out fun or play.
Why was he important, Steve?
That's a very good question. It's a very good question that I'm not sure I know how to answer. I could do the old switcheroo and say, why is anybody important? It's for what they left behind, for what they offered you and me while they were alive, for doing something that was unusual, for doing something that was enjoyable, for doing something that transformed the way we think of things. Those are important people, but there are also important people who just, through their existence, make our lives more better. And I think that Rand, as a teacher, was extremely significant. He taught many people how to think. He also taught many people how to disagree with his thinking. As a designer, he helped change the way people thought about corporate identity. Is that important in the long run? It's certainly important in the short run. We live with what we've got as tools of our lives, and I think he impacted some of those tools.
Yeah.
He was important to me because I got to know another human being that was different than I was, who thought differently and passed on what he thought to me, whether I agreed with everything or not. That's the best you can say about life. He didn't impose an ideology on me. He didn't say, don't think. He just said, here's another way of thinking.
I just want to end with a quote that you use from Patricia Allen Dreyfus, summing up his process as the contrast between the expected and the unexpected, between rough and smooth, simple and complex, line and mass, negative and positive space, up and down, photography and artwork, tight and loose, thick and thin, representation and symbol, movement and repose, color and and black and white. That's a lot.
Well, that kind of sums up everything he did. I could have said it, I suppose, but she said it better.
Very good. Well, as I say, I earlier mentioned that he showed an uncompromising dedication to his work. And I'd like to thank you for yours to the craft, to graphic design. You really have done an astounding job of documenting it. And thank you for that. And thank you for dedicating the time to talk with me today, Steve.
Well, thank you for having me.
Very good. I've been talking to Steve Heller, who is the co-chair of the
MFA design, designer as entrepreneur at the School of Visual Arts.
Very good, in New York City. Thanks again for joining us.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
See you tomorrow.
You bet. Thanks again.